Accession number 4473, reel 4.
Colonel Bryce, reel 4. Can you tell me a bit more about any other aspects of the work you did in Egypt?
Well, while I was in Egypt, I was employed on the signal office which was established in Cairo, and I was also employed as NCO in a B cable section. In the manning of the signal office, in those days, we were at headquarters, and we had line communications purely and simply, which was a sounder, a normal post office sounder, with lines out to the polygon and lines to the RAF to keep in communication with them. And we used to work what they call long and short shifts. We were accommodated in a place called Eden Park Hotel, and nearby was a swimming pool, Hezbekir Gardens. But
what was it called, the swimming pool?
Hezbekir Gardens. There was where we were stationed at the Eden Palace Hotel. We were actually accommodated in the servants' quarters, which were on top of the building. The building had a flat roof, and they had built up little rooms, etc., in which we lived. And we had three shifts. And we used to, the shifts were made up of the operators for manning the telephone exchange, which provided the communications for the headquarters, telephone communications. And as I said, we had landlines, went out to the various people, and we had operators manning each of the particular circuits. And my particular job in this headquarters, signal office, was as a assistant superintendent. Used to be two sergeant superintendents and two corporal assistant superintendents. And our particular job was to purely and simply run all the supervising the operators and keep all the records of traffic, etc. We had counter clerks. Every message had to be registered, and they either came in as an in message, which was for distribution around the headquarters to the various branches of headquarters, which used to be done by native runners. We used to have people employed there, civilians, whose job was to take these messages from us to the various branches and to bring any messages that they wanted transmitted over the landlines to go by wireless. The procedure was that we'd receive a message for dispatch, and we would route it either through the RAF over the landline and or to the Army signal station at Polygon. And from there, it would be sent by wireless either to the local stations at Abbasia, Moasca, and those places, or it would be sent direct to London, Troopers London. And that's about all I can remember of the signal office set up.
What was Troopers London?
That was, well, what is now the Ministry of Defence. It was the Army headquarters.
This was the code for them?
Yes, that was their telephone, their telegraphic name, Troopers London. And all our messages used to be made out to Troopers London and sent to them direct. Used to normally be received at Aldershot. We used to work to Aldershot. And then Aldershot used to distribute them in the UK to wherever they had to go, through the sort of available line communications and wireless communications, which were available in England at that particular time. I can't think of anything else that used to happen in the signal office. Then my next job was with the B cable section. Now, this section was provided with, in our particular case, with a telephone wagon, which consisted of a six-horse team, a limber, and attached to the limber, the cable wagon, on which you had four rolls or four drums of cable, which you used to pay out by hand as you went along. The drum was driven from the wheel. As the wheel turned, you had a belt which turned the drum, and you paid off the cable as you went along. And we used to, our particular job with cable was with the Royal Horse Artillery, who at that particular time was stationed in Cairo. And we used to go out on exercises with them when they used to do their firing of their guns, etc., and training as batteries. And our job in life was to run around the batteries, lay in the cable, so as they could work back to battery headquarters or regimental headquarters. So we lay a loop of cable around, a telephone branching off from each particular one in each particular battery, so they were in contact with their commanding officer, etc.
Why were you called B section?
In the army, in those particular days, the various companies, each of signals had three companies. One company, three company, and two company, which was up in Palestine. And each particular company was involved in a particular kind of work. And there were three company, in which I was at that particular time, at B cable section. And it also had three infantry brigade sections, J, K, and L. And the infantry brigade sections was to provide communication for infantry in the field. And that's where I used the pack sets. Incidentally, we started on carrying these off as man packs. And from there, they started providing us with pack ponies. And then from there, they modernized us a bit more and gave us limbers on which we carried the wireless sets. So I think that's about all I... One other little job we had during our period of time at B cable section was that each year they used to set up two camps, one at Mina, which was just below the pyramids, and one at Beni Yusuf. And the cavalry used to concentrate at Mina with a signal office set up, and the infantry would probably concentrate at Beni Yusuf. And we used to tie the two camps together. We used to build what they call a multi-airline.
The what airline?
Multi-airline.
How do you spell it?
A-I-R-L-I-N-E.
What airline, though?
Multi-airline.
Multi-airline,
we used to call it. And all it consisted of was light sort of poles onto which you fixed a telegraph arm. You've seen them on the telephone, the arms that you put across. And we used to run cable along them so as to connect the two camps together. They called it Morty Airline because they had more than one pair sort of on it. Mm-hmm. This is it. The cable we used to use in our particular case, a cable they called D3. We had two types of cable. You had the cable itself was for heavy work, and that was what they called D8, which was a cable made up with one strand of copper and seven strands of steel, so as to give it protection. And then that was covered with a rubber coating, and then a sort of Hessian coating on top of that. And that you'd be carried on drums and laid down to provide telephone communications for troops in the field. And the telephone cable was D3, which had one strand of copper, and as I remember it, two strands of steel, very thin steel, so as to give it protection and strength. Anything else on that? I don't think so.
Could we come on next after the work, to the setting up of camps when you're on manoeuvres?
Well, when we used to go on our manoeuvre, we used to set up two camps, one at, as I said, at Mina, and one at Beni Yusuf. And this was a tented camp, bell tents. So you used to go down and you'd have a sergeant or somebody and so I'd take your tents along with you. And they would run out of a wire or a rope or a piece of string and line up where the tent pole had to go, the centre tent pole. Only had one tent pole, obviously a centre tent pole. And then they would mark out where each individual tent had to go. And we would use a round piece of wood with a spike on it, which used to stick into the ground where the tent pole had to go. And on this, grooves were cut into this piece of wood so you could mark out your tent pegs. I think that's 16 tent pegs, I can't remember the exact number, but we used to, with a piece of string, mark out where each of the tent pegs had to go, put the tent peg in. is you lay the tent down, put the pole up through the centre of the tent and through the hole in the top of the tent. And then we'd all stand back, already waiting, and then the chap in control would blow a whistle and all the tents would come up at once. And then he'd line them all up. You see, it seemed to be an awful scramble when they were first sort of getting them all laid out and getting them all done. And then all of a sudden, everybody would stand back, would blow the whistle, and up would go all the tents. So in about 2 minutes, all these tents would come up. Then he used to go around and sort of set up the guy ropes on the tent pegs and adjust them so they were all nice and straight and all in a nice straight line. And after we'd finished that lot, we then used to have to set up all the store tents. Obviously, when you arrived at camp, the first thing you wanted to do was to get the men under cover as quickly as possible. So therefore, you used to put up the sort of local accommodation, or personnel accommodation tents, which were purely bell tents. And then we used to set up all the marquees, which were canteens, officers' messes, store tents and things like that, after we'd set up the men's tents.
Were there any accidents whilst you were in Egypt amongst the personnel?
Well, we used to have a few minor accidents, obviously, but there was those sort of cars sort of bumping into walls and bumping into each other and things like that, but nothing very serious. They were all sort of minor accidents. But we did have one particular bad accident in which a man was killed, and that was on our way down to... get the name of the place now, we were going to, but anyway, we had to pass through a place over a railway crossing at a place called Shebin al-Kanater. Now, at this particular point, the road went up at an angle to the railway line, then it turned sharply. So, if you were coming up the slope up to the railway line, it looked as though the road actually went on. But in effect, the road didn't. It turned sharply right. So on this particular night, it was night time, we were going down this exercise. On this particular night, the leading armoured car, the squadron was being led by the commanding officer in his Austin vehicle. And he was followed by a couple of armoured cars. And then I came behind the last of the armoured cars in my wire set. And I happened to know this place at Shebin al-Kanater. And as this armoured car in front of me went up this slope, I knew very well he wasn't going to make it, because you've got to start turning practically just as you got to the railway crossing. And what happened was, he went up and went right off the road. And the armoured car rolled down the embankment and fell over on its side. And I got out and got out of my car, went down to it, and they were calling the roll of the people who were actually in the armoured car, and they said, oh well, everybody's out. Well, I had a torch, and I was going around and around this armoured car, and I saw a pair of feet underneath the car. So I said, well, you can't have all the people out, there must be a chap underneath here, because you can see his boots. So anyway, we jacked the armoured car up and pulled the chap out. And he was dead. He'd definitely been killed.
Just been crushed to death.
Crushed to death. Very, very funny, really, because there was one man riding on the top, a corporal and one other on the top, and there was two blokes inside. Two chaps inside, one of the blokes on top got away clear. He must have jumped. But the car, the armoured car, really rolled right over on top of this chap, and of course crushed him to death, obviously. First time I'd ever seen anybody dead. And all through the night as I was driving, I got in communication, got back to headquarters on the wireless and told them what had happened and got them to bring forward assistance. We had quite a bit of a problem there because when we got through to the medical people and asked them if they would send an ambulance out for this particular chap and a doctor, they evidently checked up on the map where this Shebin al-Kanater was, and evidently it wasn't in our area. So they started sort of saying, well, we can't come, you'll have to get in touch with the place to which we were going. Well, obviously we had no communication with them, so we couldn't possibly have got down to get it. So what happened was, we finally gave them a map reference, which brought the scene of the accident within our area. And then they agreed to come out and send out medical assistance, which they did. But they wouldn't move until they knew it was in our area.
Did any other accidents take place?
Well, I was on one particular incident when I saw three armoured cars rolling down the hillside out on an exercise, and they're coming up and they're going at an angle across one of these big sand dunes. And these Rolls-Royce armoured cars, as far as I'm concerned, were top-heavy. And as I came over the crest of this hill, I could see these three armoured cars rolling down the hillside. And yet nobody was hurt. All we did, I went along with my vehicle with a tow rope, and just up the tow rope on the top of the armoured car, and brought the armoured cars back on their feet again, on their wheels again. But there was nobody injured. I suppose you could call that an accident.
I think you said that a murder took place.
Ah, yes, that was in... I was involved in this was because, being a Lance Corporal at that particular time, I was in charge of a barrack room, and my particular job was to check up the barrack room to see that all the jobs laid down for the men to do in the barrack room had been completed before the officer came round and inspected the barrack room for cleanliness and all that sort of business. And in the hut opposite, while I was there inspecting this hut, there was a sudden shout from the hut next to ours, and then a revolver went off, and I dashed over there and saw that a chap had shot a sergeant. According to what I was told afterwards, what had actually happened was that this particular chap had been quite a bad hat, you know. He'd always getting into trouble, and this sergeant was always chasing him, and they'd been up to the range firing a revolver, and when they came back, this chap had not handed in his unused rounds, you know. So the sergeant went in with the corporal as evidence to tell his chap to hand back the cartridges, and the chap was at the particular time had his revolver broken with the rounds in. And when the sergeant said he wanted the rounds, he sort of, you know, yelled at him to give him the round. He closed his revolver. He said, "All right, if you want these rounds, you can have it." And he fired straight in his face. And then he turned around to the corporal. He said, "You're the next, you bugger." And the corporal jumped through the window.
And he was...
And yet the chap went in. Another... I didn't go in. I was just looking through the window. But the chap went in quite happily, and he handed over the revolver just like that. No argument. Well, the sergeant, I think it was, went in and said, "Give me that revolver," and the chap handed over quite happily. And as far as I understood, he was tried, found guilty of murder, and was executed in the barracks of Babylon Gate, I think, in Cairo.
A firing squad.
In fact, yes. And following on from that, it's very funny, I can't guarantee the truth of this at all. But I understand. I met a chap on the boat coming on. This happened while I was at Almere, and the case went on for quite a long time. I thought it finally finished. Then I met a chap out of the Middlesex Regiment on the troops that were coming on. And he told me about it. He said, in fact, he had been one of the firing squad. I don't know how true that is. And he reckoned that it was the regiment had to provide the firing squad. And one of the members of the firing squad refused to take part. And this chap was in the glass house at that particular time, in the military prison. And anybody who volunteered to take part in this, or to replace this fella on the firing squad, would get his sentence washed out. And he told me that he took part in this firing squad.
So your informant had been in the glass house?
Yes, in the guard room, in the glass house. Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't guarantee that. This is only what they call hearsay, isn't it?
This is what he told you?
Yeah, this is it. How true it is, I wouldn't know.
Were there any signs of mental crack-up amongst any of the troops in Egypt?
Not really. I think one of the things was that our job was probably, I can speak mainly from signals and from the 12 lounges. I should say that our job mainly were probably interesting enough to fill in your time so that there would be no sort of mental strain, because there was no war on or anything like that at that particular time, so I wouldn't think of. But I did have one particular case that I was on a firing range and it sat in front of me. We loaded, standing by, waiting to go down and fire. And he put his head down on the muzzle of his rifle and pressed the trigger. And just before he pressed the trigger, he pulled his head back. But I think that was an attempt to commit suicide. What happened, I don't really know after that, because again, being a junior NCO at that particular time, I wasn't interested.
So you didn't hear of any other suicide cases?
No, I can't remember any other suicide cases at all. No.
I think there was one occasion when you saw Mountbatten in Egypt.
Yes, this was during the time when I was a detachment commander in K Infantry Brigade Signal Section. And at that particular time, the Med Fleet were in Alexandria. And every time the Mediterranean Fleet came into Alexandria, a lot of sailors used to come down to visit our particular barracks, etc., and stay with us for a fortnight. Now, during this period of time, Lord Lewis Mountbatten, who at that time was the Fleet Wireless Officer of the Mediterranean Fleet, came down on a visit. And he wanted to have a look at our wireless setup. And as a result of that, the commanding officer organized exhibition, or display, of the various types of equipment that we were using for communications. And one of the things he had was to lay on this PAC wireless set with the four people concerned, and to show Lord Lewis Mountbatten what the kit was made up, and the drill in loading it on the man's back and unloading it, etc. So Lord Lewis came along, and we gave this demonstration. And as soon as we gave him the demonstration, he asked if he could take part in the demonstration, well, take part and see what the set was like, which he did do. And of course, we gave him the heaviest load possible, which happened to be the battery. And then we went through the drill, and the drill, in this particular case, the four men of the detachment paraded with the set and the load in front of them. And on the command left turn, they left turned, and the man, number two, loaded number one's pack on, and number three loaded number two pack on, number four did number three. And then they about turned, and number three loaded number four. So anyway, having done this, put on this pack, and having gone through the drill, we went for a sort of small stroll across the Maidan, as we call it, which was a sort of desert affair, which he didn't take too kindly to. But he was willing. He went so far, and he took it down. Then he came back, and at that particular time, we'd had what they call a number one set, which was just coming into the service at that particular time. And this also was shown on a demonstration later on our table. And he happened to talk to me about this. And we had a bit of an argument, actually, because he was very clued up. I mean, he was a clever wise officer, far cleverer than what I was at my particular job. And he was asking what the power drain on the battery was, because it was a fixed dry HT battery, high tension battery, of dry cells. And he wanted to know what current was taken when the set was actually working on receive and transmit. And he didn't agree with the figures I gave him. And so I stood by the figures I gave him, but he said no. From his technical knowledge, it wasn't possible. Probably he was right, I wouldn't know. And this is where I sort of had my contact with Lord Lewis Mountbatten.